Matthew 26, verses 1 to 5, and then 14 to 21. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, "As you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. "But not during the festival," they said, "or there may be a riot among the people." Then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" So they counted out for him 30 silver coins. From then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" He replied, "Go into the city to a certain man and tell him, 'The teacher says my appointed time is near. I am going to celebrate the Passover with my disciples at your house.'" So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them and prepared the Passover. When evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12. And when they were eating, he said, "Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me." We have quite somber words this morning to approach, to come face to face with in God's word. I want to turn away from that for just a moment to something which could be just as alarming, I don't know. If you saw on a piece of paper in front of you the words "history exam," I hope that doesn't send a pulse of fear racing through your veins. You're there, you're in the middle of the exam hall, you've checked that your pen works, and it's all silent, and the invigilator says, "Turn the paper over," and it's history. So the first thing you read is this: "What caused the First World War?" This is a typical kind of question. It's a very good question to illustrate something very specific. The thing is, there are various answers. There are many answers that could be given to what looks like a very innocuous, very simple question. Some people might start off by answering that there'd been an arms race, that at that point in the year 1914, as far as I understand it, for decades, easily 20, 30 years or more, European countries have been busy arming themselves, building up their armies and navies. So they were bristling with weapons at that point. But second, there was imperialism. Many countries were competing with each other for territory and for power and influence around the globe. But also, there are other factors. There is what would be called in the textbooks mutual defense alliances. For instance, Serbia and Russia were best friends. But Russia also had an agreement, as I understand it, with France. And France was very friendly with Britain. And those things meant a kind of network of connections. Meanwhile, Austria-Hungary could always count on the support of Germany. And those things suddenly became very relevant in late June 1914. Some of you will, of course, remember. I'm not sure. I don't remember. That was the time when a Serbian assassin shot and killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary. So, because of those other factors, Austria-Hungary immediately declared war upon Serbia. And because Serbia was being threatened by a large neighbour, Russia started to mobilise. And because Germany saw that, and they were friendly with Austria-Hungary and not with Russia, they declared war on Russia. And then, like a set of dominoes all knocking each other over, everything else that we know in the history books kind of slotted into place. And country after country found itself dragged into the conflict. Now that's just my very, very rough summary. Some of you probably know those things better than I do. But it's a well-known example a very simple looking question, a question that doesn't really threaten you too much at first, you realize there is a very complex answer made up of all those different aspects. We're going to see in a moment or two another example of something similar to that, a question that has potentially a lot of answers. We're approaching Easter. It's a bit, the lights don't matter because I think you can see a picture of crosses, but we don't need to focus on that too much just immediately yet. We opened up Matthew chapter 26. It's a point in Matthew's gospel where he very clearly says to us, the teaching of Jesus is now over. Now it's time for the action. Our reading, those verses that I read, opened up with these words, when Jesus had finished saying all these things. And there's more in those words than meets the eye, because the time for teaching, the time for words was over. Jesus actually says relatively little from that point on in Matthew's gospel, because now's the time for action. The timeline is really very clear indeed. This is now the Wednesday of what we call Passion Week. The Jewish feast of Passover took place properly on the Friday of that week. That was the day the Passover lambs would be slaughtered. And that's significant, of course, and Jesus actually says to his disciples on the Wednesday, Passover is just around the corner and the Son of Man will be crucified. He links those two things. At that time of year, they would also start to clear out the leaven, the yeast from their homes, and that would begin on the day before, on the Thursday, which is why the Gospel writers do sometimes refer to the Thursday as the first day of the Unleavened Bread Festival. But it was the combination of those two festivals, those two feasts, Passover, which was one very special day, and Unleavened Bread, which was a whole week, the combination of those produced the biggest and most important of all of the events in the Jewish calendar. Pilgrims from all over the known world would gather in Jerusalem, tens and hundreds of thousands of them. But there is a massive dilemma as this chapter opens, as chapter 26 starts off, and you can sense it, you can hear it when you read these verses. On the Wednesday of that week, 2 days before Passover, a dilemma felt principally by the chief priests and the elders, the leaders of the Jewish nation. They were desperate to arrest Jesus and have him killed. You can read that in those verses. It's in verse 4 and 5. But they couldn't do it. They were powerless to do what they wanted to do. And the reason really was they didn't dare. They did not dare to take action. A festival, a feast like that, should have been their big chance in one respect, because that was when Jesus was right there in Jerusalem under their noses. He was there in the temple courts every day in full public view. But by day, he was always surrounded by great crowds. And many in those crowds were his supporters. They were sympathetic with him. And that gave him real protection, because the elders and the chief priests were scared of those crowds. And by night, he could just slip away undetected, because the city was so crowded, he and his disciples could disappear into the crowds, and the authorities had no idea where they went. That is very obvious from all of the gospel accounts. There are a couple of different places where they went. We know about them because it's reported to us, but they didn't know. He went to Gethsemane sometimes. Gethsemane was a small, clearly a secluded, almost certainly a private garden, an olive grove, on the slopes of the Mount of Olives, just outside the city. Their access to it would have been a private arrangement between Jesus and the owner of the garden. Sometimes, some nights when they were in Jerusalem, they went further from the city to the village of Bethany. And Bethany was a place where Jesus had good friends, friends that were so close and so loyal to him, they provided a safe house. Jesus and his disciples could go there, I believe, and really rest from the pressures that they were under. And there's one other event, of course, we know, not yet reached, well, it was there actually in those verses, but on the Thursday, there was to be a final meal, the final meal that Jesus was going to share with his disciples. And for that, the venue was not even known to the disciples. Jesus had arranged it, again privately, with a supporter in the city of Jerusalem, and it was to be in a room in his house. And when the time came for it, Jesus told two disciples, this is reported in one of the other Gospels, he told two disciples to locate a man they did not know yet and be led to that house. They didn't even know where it was going to be. And that also is significant. But there's the dilemma. It must have been tantalizing and infuriating for the leaders of the Jews because they could not lay a finger on Jesus. Until suddenly in walked the answer to their problem. Judas Iscariot walked in and said to them, "What will you give me if I hand him over to you?" And he was one of Jesus' inner circle, of course. He was one of the 12 disciples. So what we need to see today, very briefly, is that for the events of the next two or three days to proceed, the betrayal of Jesus by Judas Iscariot, the handing over, was genuinely the key. It was the key, it was the trigger, the pivot on which everything else hinged. And you can see how Matthew emphasizes it four times. Those are actually the same word in Greek, betrayed and handed over. In some translations, they say delivered up. But it's the same word, one word. The Son of Man will be handed over. Jesus said that. Judas said, if I hand him over to you, what will you give me? And then he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. And then Jesus said again to his disciples, one of you will betray me. It's time to pose then the question that I hinted at earlier. Not an exam, but a question that I think is very important for us, for each one of us to grapple with. Why did Jesus die on the cross? What was it? What was it that drove him, this man from Nazareth, to the cruel cross on the hill of Calvary on that particular Passover Friday? Why was he nailed to a cross to die? And similar to what I suggested before in that other example, there could be different ways to answer that. We might point out, well, officially, he was seen as a threat to the authority of Rome. We might say, well, he wasn't a threat to the authority of Rome, but officially, that was the verdict that was reached. Or we might say, because of the hatred and jealousy harbored towards him by the Jewish leaders. We might say, because he was betrayed by Judas Iscariot. In Matthew's Gospel, you can see all those different elements. They are all at play. They're true. None of them is wrong. And if we were students writing an essay, we could evaluate them all, assess them, see what we thought, and reach our opinion as to which was the most important. But there is more that we must see in Matthew's Gospel. He shows us something quite separate from the jealousies and the turmoil and the plotting. He shows us that there is divine purpose. There is God's purpose, which is at work in all of these events. And it's not just present in the events, it is driving the events, moving them forwards to the conclusion that we know is the eventual conclusion. For one thing, we can see Jesus himself told his disciples what was going to happen. He knew in advance, the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. And then at the meal, one of you will betray me. And then, of course, there's also the evidence of prophecy. What the prophets had written in the Old Testament, which Jesus knew, and which others should have known as well. They would have known. So when Jesus was arrested in Gethsemane on the following night, in the night of Thursday night and Friday morning, he actually said, all of these things that have happened are a fulfillment of what the prophets wrote. We are meant to see that God's plan is shaping all of these events, not just loosely, generally guiding and nudging, not like what they talk about now, the government's nudge unit, to try to produce the required behavior in the population. Not at all. God is fully in control. And he guides and knows every detail. There is no detail, there is no moment of these events which escapes his attention, which falls outside his sovereign control. What's the reason for emphasizing this? It's because we must not for one moment imagine that Jesus was the helpless victim of circumstances, that there was an unfortunate fate driving things and he was powerless to do anything about it, that he was driven to the cross of Calvary just by some cruel fate. On the contrary, he anticipated, he foresaw, and he even had to prompt many of the different elements of these events to make sure they happened. He was calm and he was fully in control. At the same time, Matthew does not play down the element of human responsibility. It's present and it's very real. It's relevant in these events. We read about the actions of the Roman authorities and the Jewish leaders and the crowds in Jerusalem, and specifically today, Judas Iscariot. And it was their conscious, deliberate actions which ensured that Jesus was betrayed and arrested and tortured and tried and condemned and killed. And what's the reason for emphasizing that? The human responsibility. It's because we must not for one moment imagine, as well as what I've just said, we mustn't imagine that the human agents who played a part in these events were somehow just puppets being controlled and playing a role which was written for them. On the contrary, they, each one of them, exercised free will as we all do. They made conscious decisions. They exercised choices and chose to act in the way that they did. So there are these two great dynamics at work. There are the purposes of God, and there is responsible human action. And I'm not suggesting that there's a kind of struggle between these two, as if they pull in opposite directions, not at all. And they're somehow finely balanced. Of course, it's not like that at all. What I mean is this: both are true, and both are visibly at work. And it is necessary for us to try to grasp that. So I'm going to return finally to our question. Why did Jesus die on the cross? And I'd like us to consider, in fact, simplifying things a little bit from where I was before. There are really two ways to answer it. An observer of the events might well say, because of human sin. And that would be fully correct. If you had been a journalist in Jerusalem and observed those events, and it was your task to report on them, describe everything that you saw and heard, write it down, make some kind of analysis of it and send it in with your weekly report to the news programs, what would you have said? It was because of human sin. I witnessed jealousy and hatred and envy and fear all whipped up into a frenzy of rage which drove that man to the hill of Calvary and to the cross. That's what you would have described. And remember this as well. There were thousands of people who were there in Jerusalem again at Pentecost only a few weeks later, and many of them were obviously the same people. And we hear what Peter said to them. Do you remember that? This is in Acts chapter 2. Peter said to them with this challenge, "You put him to death by nailing him to the cross." And they didn't deny it. They fully accepted responsibility for what they and others had done. And they were horrified. We're told they were cut to the heart. And hundreds, we're told, in fact, 3,000 in one day, repented of what they had done and were forgiven. So there is the human responsibility, the human sin, which was present. And then the Christian believer can also say more than that. And you can't read very far in the Bible without getting this message as well. Why did Jesus die on the cross? Because of God's great purpose for humanity, for the redemption of the world he loves. It had been determined, it had been settled in the eternal purposes of God before the beginning of time, and nothing would prevent it from taking place. And the apostles actually grasped this very, very quickly. I just read to you what Peter said at Pentecost from Acts chapter 2, but I only read half the verse. Here's the full verse. Here's all of it. This is Acts 2, verse 23. Just look at the way these are blended together. Two separate things. This man was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge. And you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. But God raised him from the dead. Isn't that an incredible verse? Beautifully constructed, I'd suggest to you, because it is such an accurate statement of what happened at the cross of Calvary. In the middle of that verse, there is the responsible, culpable human action. Human sin. You, with the help of wicked men, put him to death. But wrapped around that, before and after, are the purposes of God. Do you see that? Our sin, your sin, my sin, if we will acknowledge it and confess it and repent of it, can all be encompassed by God's grace. Finally, not very visibly, but finally, one of the most famous and striking paintings of the cross of Christ that's ever been painted, I believe, is this one by Salvador Dalí. It's striking not only because of the unique angle. He chose to paint the crucifixion as if seen from above. It's also striking because if you get up close, if you're able to look closely at it, he hasn't painted any nails. It actually looks as if Christ's body is suspended in the air. It's not fixed physically to the cross at all. You could rephrase our question just very slightly. What held Jesus to the cross? What held Jesus to the cross? And an answer we could give, which would not be wrong, would be human sin. Human sin. My sin and your sin. The rebellion and the pride and the cruelty of all the ages. In a few moments, we'll sing these words. Behold the man upon a cross, my sin upon his shoulders. It was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. Now, I think Salvador Dalí, the painter, couldn't paint the sin, could he? I'm very glad he didn't even try to paint the sin. It would have made a grotesquely ugly, unimaginably ugly painting if he had done that. But all the same, our sin, although it's invisible there in that painting, it's real. It's real. And you could say it is what held him to the cross. And it's terrible. And we can't deal with it ourselves, our sin. Have you taken yours to him? The only way you can be free of it is to take it to him. When we confess it and repent of it, he does away with it completely. That's the reason for the cross. And what we find there is exactly what I've tried to shape this morning in those two different elements of the answer that we need. But when we take our sin to him and he does away with it, we find that we are then caught up in the purposes of God, the eternal and perfect and beautiful purposes of God, which is where we belong. Let's close our worship this morning by singing straight away that hymn. It's number 778. It is on the screen, sorry, so you won't need the books. Number 778. How deep the Father's love for us.